This is the Reason Podcast, and I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. One of the most interesting outcomes of the 2016 election is that about 10% of people who voted for Barack Obama ended up voting for Donald Trump. And those switch voters helped Trump eke out a victory. Many of the switchers were white, and many lived in the post-industrial Midwest. They voted for Obama in 2008 because they wanted change they could believe in, and in 2016, they were still looking for change, might have given up on hope. In his deeply researched and heavily reported new book, Alienated America, Why Some Places Thrive While Others Collapsed, Timothy P. Carney goes on a deep dive, does a deep dive on many of these places that voted first for Obama and then for Trump. It's a powerful, provocative, and in many ways a deeply disturbing look at the contemporary political, social, cultural, economic landscape of America. For today's podcast, I'll be talking with Carney, who writes for the Washington Examiner and is a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Tim, thanks for joining the Reason Podcast.
Thank you very much, Nick, for having me.
You bet. Give the elevator pitch version of the book.
So what Donald Trump told us is that his victory told us was that the suffering of the working class is a real thing. When the guy who said the American dream is dead carried the Republican primaries in state after state. And I wanted to know what was driving that belief that the American dream was dead. And I started by looking at the places where Trump did worse in the primaries. And a lot of these were places, either elite places where everybody has a college education, or some really strong religious places like the Mormons in Salt Lake City and the Dutch Reformed in Western Michigan. What did they have in common that made them immune to this idea that the American dream was dead? They had strong institutions of civil society that bring people together, provide a local safety net and a sense of purpose. And so the plague of middle America that leads to this idea that the American dream is dead is the fact that these people are missing these institutions. They don't have them. They instead have a state of alienation where they're not connected to others.
So, well, let's start by talking about Trump a little bit. First off, how do you orient to Trump? I know you're conservative, you're libertarian. I assume to the extent that you affiliate with parties, you affiliate more with the Republican Party. But are you pro-Trump, anti-Trump, anti-anti-Trump, never Trump?
If you could give me how many would I have? I'd have one and three antis, anti-Trump, right, but also anti-anti-anti-Trump, or okay, maybe four. I'm having trouble counting. I did not vote for him in the general. I certainly did not vote for him in the primaries. At the Washington Examiner, we have a policy of praising him when he's right and criticizing when he's wrong, including the way in which he's sort of he's wrong to the core in that he's the wrong person to be the president of the United States.
So, well, to go back to, you know, kind of the starting point of the framework of the book, Trump, you know, he said the American dream is dead and that he was going to restore it. You know, how is that what appealed to those voters who, you know, the Obama switch voters?
Certainly the idea that the dream is dead resonated with them. Whether they believed his ability to bring it back is a more complicated question that we should talk about, because you and I certainly don't believe that a president of the United States can bring it back.
No.
But articulating that it's dead, it's sort of like being a good friend and husband. You have to learn just to sort of express and empathize with a person. And Trump, ironically, was just doing a really good job of doing it.
So it was nothing short of fascinating that, you know, a billionaire who obviously has spent very little time in, you know, the Upper Peninsula or, you know, Western Pennsylvania, connected with people there much more than Hillary Clinton, who, if nothing else, was, you know, married to the guy who, you know, kind of brought empathy into politics, you know, by feeling people's pain. So Trump, and before we get to talking about how Trump is doing, or if he's doing anything on this, you know, to help revive these areas, I mean, in the book, you know, and it's clear throughout that Trump's rise is kind of an effect, not a cause of the, you know, of the problems in these places.
Yep.
Go into what are some of the, you know, what are the primary you know, causes of this alienation that you found in particular places. And, you know, when we assume that that feeling like you're getting screwed, feeling that your dream is dead, that's one of the reasons you were willing to vote for Trump, because it's the same reason you voted for Obama. McCain wasn't speaking to those people in 2008.
So I think the economic factor that Trump focuses on is the first step, right? The factory does shut down in a lot of these places, but I argue that that's incomplete. That to really understand the alienation and this anger and why, you know, Pittsburgh had the factory shut down, but it bounced back up. And Pittsburgh didn't vote for Trump, but the rural areas outside of Pittsburgh, after the factory shut down, because they were just a little thinner, the population density, the number of institutions weren't there as much, you had these things shut down. It was the cafe, the diner, then it was a church. And when those things shut down, people aren't connected to one another. They don't have that personal level safety net. And that loss of those, you know, what we old conservatives call the mediating institutions, that's the cause of alienation.
So when did the job shut down exactly? And I'm thinking, and I'm going to mispronounce his name, the South Bend mayor who's announced that he's running for the Democratic nomination, Pete Buttigieg, or whatever. But, you know, one of the things that I've met him and talked with him a bit, and he talks a bit about, or he talks a lot about how in, I think it was 1962 or 63, Studebaker left South Bend, and it never really came back from that. It was a major car company. When you look at industrial jobs in particular, and it's kind of, you know, we've almost forgotten, but how much Trump kept talking about factory jobs and bringing back good factory jobs. But as a percentage of the employment, you know, of the labor force, industrial labor peaked in 1943 or 44 during World War II. It's been declining as a percentage ever since. The high watermark of people employed in industrial jobs or factory jobs was in 1977 or 80. You know, these jobs have been gone for a long time. Is it just that it's taken forever for that alienation to kind of fully, you know, marinate and saturate all of these places? Or are people claiming that's the cause and it's something else?
So, yeah, I mean, the 1950s, I start at one point with 1955 being the peak year that the Pittsburgh Wheeling Steel Factory, their peak year of output. And then Europe starts the competition. Right. And then decades later, it's China and
Japan before that and stuff.
And Japan. And so one of the things is that a lot of the industrial decline, as you're saying, it was steady, but also, again, I think when you say the factory closed and then life sucked in our town, that's skipping the step of the factory close and then the diner that the factory workers went to close. And then, again, the church closed and these other things. And then just it was a bunch of people living there without things to bring them together. So that's one reason I think it can take a generation, because then the kids growing up in an alienated environment, they're not as likely to get married, to build, to raise families, to do the other things that then can cause the good outcomes. But you hinted, I think, at maybe these are just a bunch of whiny old white guys who don't really have anything to complain about. Am I right that you were hinting at that?
Not necessarily hinting, but this is as somebody who's lived, or, you know, until recently for the past 20 years, either full-time or part-time, I was living in southwestern Ohio, which is a state, you know, and I actually, you know, in Oxford, Ohio, which is about 15 or 20 miles from Middletown, Ohio, where J.D. Vance's Hillbilly Elegy, which you mentioned frequently through the book, and is located. And, you know, people have been leaving that state and that part of the state for decades now. And I'm not saying, you know, if you're complaining, you know, why don't you just move, or any, it's more complex than that. But it's, you know, I'm the stories that people tell themselves can either empower them or not. I went to grad school in Buffalo in the early 90s, and people there were talking about how this used to be, you know, a thriving town until NAFTA or something like that, you know. And it was like, no, it actually, its population peaked in 1950, and you were already, between 1970 and 1990, they had already lost like another 25 or 30%. And, you know, so it, you know, it, I'm very interested in those steps. And I think you're getting to one. I think one of the really strengths of the book is that economics matters, but you're constantly saying economics is not the absolute explanation for all of this stuff. So So it kind of work through those steps of what are the other mediating institutions? I mean, like the jobs go, you know, and a lot of people leave because a lot of these places actually relative to other parts of the country have lost population. But the jobs leave, a lot of the people leave, and one assumes, you know, the people either who have more options or more ambition are leaving as well. But then
if you have a public school, like those might be the most involved parents who were running the PTA are the ones who are leaving. Remember, we had a lot more diversity of education level and income, a lot more heterogeneity in most of our towns and cities and neighborhoods in the 60s and 70s than we do now. Now things are more stratified. So in other words, now you go to an elite neighborhood, every mom is a PTA mom. Every dad is able to coach T-ball. And those used to be more evenly spread out. So it might be the sort of most involved parents are leaving. What is a good public school? A good public school is a public school with lots of involved parents. So that's one of the steps is the schools become worse. And I referred to sort of the diner that existed mostly for the guys before and after their shifts to get breakfast and a cup of coffee. And when that shuts down, well, sure, you're still able to go to the grocery store and you can drink your coffee at home now because we've got better technology, et cetera. But then the people aren't being brought together. But ultimately, I mean, the cover of Alienated America is a shuttered church.
Right.
For middle class and working class America, the fundamental institution of civil society has always been church and the things that spin out of that, the Knights of Columbus,
I didn't think we were going to be talking about the alt-right and white supremacist groups, but I guess we are if we're talking about the Knights of Columbus, right? And I say this obviously also, or like you, at least I was raised Catholic, but CYO, Catholic Youth Organization, basketball, soccer, along with Little League and more secular groups, but churches perform a wide variety of functions. So talk about how in particularly in places, I guess in places that have gone kind of downhill or to seed, what has been going on in terms of church life?
So this is a surprising thing to some people, but small town, rural, Republican voting America is not a bunch of either tightly knit, rugged communities or a bunch of people clinging bitterly to their Bibles and their and their church.
They may still have guns, but they're no longer clinging to God.
Yeah. But here's the most important thing. Religiosity can be expressed in many different ways. The most important one for this book, for politics, for good outcomes, and for alienation, is about attendance. It's about belonging to something and going to a place where you meet people. So the main thing is there's one story from the sort of the Pittsburgh area. I know this woman, and Pittsburgh Diocese just consolidated her parents' parish with something else. So now they belong to St. Raphael's St. Mary's, but it's at St. Mary's. They stopped going to church because St. Raphael's wasn't open anymore. So as a Catholic, you're still supposed to go every Sunday, but when your local institution shuts down, you just sort of unplug from any institution. And that's really the killer part right there. It's not so much a loss of belief or anything like that. It's mostly a loss of belonging that has these real measurable impacts. And in rural America, there's really low church attendance among the working class, except in some of these extraordinary pockets that I talk about.
And so this is the, you mentioned the Dutch Reformed in Michigan or the Mormons in Utah and stuff. They're pushing back against that. What are people doing in these pockets, you know, these kind of pro-Trump desiccated pockets? Because, you know, they're not working. They're not going to church. And also not belonging to a church, it means they may not be, you know, playing basketball in leagues or baseball or all of this. So how do they spend their days and how can they spend their days?
A lot of watching TV. It's amazing by class, if you look at education and income levels, how much more TV is watched by the working class. My colleague at AEI, Nick Ebersat, did work on the people who dropped out of labor force. They're not spending their time? Obviously, they probably don't have a lot of money, but it's not like they're spending their free time either volunteering or what was the name of the the club that in Jeeves and Wooster? They're not a bunch of dilettantes off with their buddies. They're alone and spending a lot of time watching TV and watching cable news and getting riled up either against or in favor of Donald Trump.
How are they supporting themselves?
So this is the interesting thing. Since I just mentioned Trump, the actual Trump voters, if you look at exit polls, at individuals, Trump voters are doing fine economically. They're living in places that are collapsed. So if we go to the neighbors of Trump's core supporters, these are people who tend to be living off of disproportionately living off of food stamps and disability. I mean, the disability one, for some reason, that always kills me because you know disability claims go down when the economy gets better. So it's almost as part of you could think they're just a bunch of cheats. But on the other hand, part of their disability is that there's not a job out there, and that kills them even more. That makes their back worse. That makes their depression worse.
And this is, I mean, part of the collapse, I think, that certainly that you're writing about has to do with the reduction in the workforce participation rate of men of, you know, essentially able-bodied men or prime year earning year men from 25 to 54. So how is that playing out in this part of the country?
So that's where we get the rise of the deaths of despair. So people dying of alcohol, drugs, and suicide, it's that group. I mean, maybe the later end of that group, but all of it, sort of middle America, not college educated, white males is where the rise in the big numbers of that is. And again, low church attendance, low belonging, low civic activity, all that stuff that Robert Putnam wrote about in Bowling Alone almost 20 years ago, that's most prevalent among males in without a college degree in middle America.
And yet it's also true, as you were talking about, that Trump voters themselves seem to be doing pretty well. If I'm remembering correctly, in exit polls, Hillary Clinton won among voters from households that had made $50,000 or less. Trump actually did better in 50 to 100, and I think 100 to 150, and then they started evening out again. And obviously, it was very close, you know, in various ways. But so it's, I mean, it you know, the Trump appeal, you know, then, you know, I guess, you know, part of his message was that he was acknowledging people that felt like they're ignored by America, they're ignored by the economy, by the, you know, the kind of cultural class. He acknowledged them. How is he doing, or is there, you know, what is he doing to remediate their, you know, what were the things? Was it enough for him to just say, hey, I'm feeling your pain, and she's not? Or, you know, what were the things that he promised them that would have hooked them?
So politically, what a lot of people want is somebody to feel their pain. And Hillary, you know, was saying in Pennsylvania right before the election, the American dream, America already is great. The American dream is as alive as, and so that just sort of seemed like a finger in the eye of these people who said they were suffering. I argue, if I'm going to point to the best thing that Trump is doing for these people, it's stopping the effort by Democrats to try to push the church out of the public square. That the Obama administration's arguments in Hobby Lobby was basically, you lose your right to free exercise of religion the moment you step into the public square. They would use the term freedom of worship instead of freedom, free exercise of religion. So that's the most important thing, because again, protecting and hoping for sort of a revival of these churches is, I think, one of the most important things we can do. But that said, that's what Trump's not doing to hurt them. There isn't very much a president of the United States can do to help them. And that's the cruel, bitter irony, is that when people lose sort of a local politics, and I mean politics not even in the sense of town council, but just like your swim club, your PTA, when you lose that, you turn to a more centralized politics. And then that's a vicious circle. That just creates more alienation.
So, and I want to talk in a minute about over-centralization, which is one of a main section of your book that I found particularly fascinating. But before we leave this and talking about the economic roots, I mean, because at rock bottom, there is an economics problem here. In a thriving economy, more people participate, and there's a thicker social kind of cultural web. But you point out, you stress again and again, and I think in a way that many libertarians are smart to listen to, that it's not simply about the Benjamins, at all. And in the reverse of that, you go to Williston, North Dakota, which was home to, the big shale oil explosion, where it was a town that's really in the middle of nowhere. Or if it's not in the middle of nowhere, you can see the end of, the beginning of nowhere there. And it's a boom town. And there was tons of money going in. And explain how that didn't solve a lot of the problems that you're talking about.
Yeah, so one of the big debates that interesting debates you get in sort of journalism and Twitter and that stuff is about the retreat from marriage. It's the working class that's getting married less. And there's a sort of materialistic argument, I would call it. Oh, well, it's because these people don't have enough money to raise families. So the free market argument is get them better jobs and they'll do it. The left argument is give them more welfare and they'll get married. The counter argument is, well, maybe some of the causality goes other ways. My conclusion is sort of it's really complicated and you got to look at it as an ecosystem, because what happened was when you Williston, these guys get $18 an hour right out of high school. They're getting a good wage. That's, the number of hours they're working in these man camps in these oil fields. They're making $60,000 a year and they're right out of high school and they have no living expenses because the oil company pays for it. None of they didn't return to marriage. The women in Williston weren't getting married anymore. And the sociologists who did this study, they looked at sort of even more normal fracking towns that weren't so far separated, like places in Pennsylvania, and they found the same exact thing. There was an uptick in pregnancy. There was not an uptick in marriage. So if you don't have a community already there, injecting money isn't going to get people to raise families. And I suspect that it's the same with other sort of positive outcomes, that money can help a little, but if it's not part of already a strong, healthy community, it's not going to be the answer.
So let's talk a little bit about over-centralization. And you kind of sketched out briefly, how this works, and that, a low trust society or something, people look to the government to do more and more stuff. And then also in a poor place, that government is going to be located further and further away because there's no local tax base and there's no local power structure. How is over-centralization playing out, and how is it exacerbating the trends that you write about in Alienated America?
So the federal government does have an effect of crowding out charitable spending on welfare, on feeding the poor and that sort of thing. And we don't even have to settle the argument over whether it's, about the net gains, because surely it doesn't crowd out dollar for dollar. The Great Society, the New Deal, they pumped more money into sort of feeding hungry people, housing homeless people, clothing the poor, medical care, than we're going into it beforehand. But they crowded out much of that. So that makes these institutions, whether they're churches or community organizations, that makes them less important in their communities. And often they end up fading away. So that's one aspect of it. It's a big government crowding out effect. But I think there's also sort of a cultural and media aspect of it, right? That as people, either man's a political animal and he wants to sort of shape the world around him. And that doesn't have to mean sort of big government busybody. It can just mean being involved in your local swim club, et cetera. Mm-hmm. As you don't have as many of those things to get involved in, then you focus your political attention on the central stage, on hating or supporting Donald Trump or Barack Obama or the Iraq War or these things that you don't have any effect over and might not even have that much of an effect on you. And so that's sort of the way in which our attention spans, our political efforts are over-centralized in a way that then steals even more attention from the local institutions that do exist. So it's this vicious circle.
In that section about over-centralization, which I, again, also thought was interesting and both a challenge to and in line with certain libertarian kind of ideas, you also talk about big business. How is, you know, how is over-centralization? I mean, I think a lot of people, anybody who, you know, who, and everybody is a critic of the Great Society, of the way that it kind of, you know, it ended up, it injected more money into a system, but it kind of corroded all of the networks and arteries and the, you know, the thickness of a social web. But what about business? Like, how does business fit into the over-centralization problem?
So I just use the image of a strip mall that has a Walmart replacing a downtown that has, you know, many different things that all of them add up to do what Walmart does, whether mm-hmm. it's the one sporting goods store, the one clothing store, the one grocer, and the coffee shop. And I mean, this is sort of one of the oldest debates on the right, right? Is sort of, should we care about that Main Street? Aren't the people getting this stuff so much cheaper? But you drive to the Walmart, you don't walk there, you don't have the serendipitous encounters with your neighborhood, and you start to lose a local sort of distinctiveness. Your town mm-hmm. loses some of its character. I mean, I don't think that's as important, though, as the fact of institutions that bring us together with other people, even if it's accidentally, even if we think right. we're going out to get a cup of coffee or to pick up a bag of sugar. One of the virtues that we've gotten from it over the generations is bumping into the neighbor who you can just say, he says, what's going on? Oh, I have this horrible problem with my basement flooding. And then he gives you the advice on getting different gutters mm-hmm. or who he introduces you to his sister who's single and just moved back into town. All the different benefits that we got sort of accidentally from a downtown, a Main mm-hmm. Street, that sort of thing. That's a big part of it. But also I talk about big business and big labor. In America and in England, it's just this horrible dysfunctional relationship where they're necessarily adversarial. And it doesn't have to be that way. I mean, you and I both have good relations with sort of our colleagues. I'm a boss now, and I have a good relation with the people who work for me, and I have a good relation with my boss.
Well, they have to tell you that, but you know, just trust me, when you step down, you know, they'll stop returning your calls. But
yes, but that big business, big mm-hmm. labor relationship is not, it's not a relationship. It's just an adversarial encounter. And I think that that's also been another big problem for the working class, is that the workplace has decreasingly been an institution of civil society in and of itself, where you can get all those benefits from interacting with your peers.
You know, kind of intellectually, the book, I think it's fair to say, has two large kind of inspirations. And you mentioned one of them, Robert Putnam, who got 20 years ago wrote Bowling Alone or close to it. And mm-hmm. more recently, a book called Our Kids. The other person is Charles Murray, who whose book Falling Apart, or is a Falling
Coming Apart,
Coming Apart, excuse me. What was interesting is that they essentially had the same analysis of, you know, of contemporary America, that there's this rise in, you know, kind of enemy and alienation because a lot of mediating people are segregating themselves into more and more like communities in terms of education, in terms of occupation and things like that, and that certain people are being left behind. They can't really acknowledge each other because ideologically, you know, they're on opposite sides of the fence. And it was explain, you know, how their work kind of informs your framework of this book.
So, yeah, the Putnam, I remember finishing college when that book was coming out and sort of being introduced to the idea of the third place as an important institution. It always planted a seed in my brain. But when I was reading Coming Apart, I got near the end and I was just starting to, you know, I think I was reading it after Piketty came out with his mm-hmm. book, Capital in America or whatever. And he just, all the talk was about inequality. And one of the things that really bugged me was that the people who made more money tended to be happier than people who made less money. I just mm-hmm. thought that really is a problem. And that's too almost materialistic. I didn't want that to be true. But then Murray, in near the back of Coming Apart, said that is true. And if you it becomes not true if you were somehow to control mostly for how connected you feel to your community and whether how good you feel about your family ties. More or less, wealthy people were just more likely to have strong communities and strong mm-hmm. families. And that was what was giving them the leg up in happiness. And I remember reading that chart at the Stained Glass pub, my local pub in Silver mm-hmm. Spring, and thinking, that's it. that's the answer. And what did I have to add? I spent a lot more time in the bars of Williston, right, in Southwest PA than Murray did. And just I thought it, you know, in the Trump era, it certainly, we needed an explanation for why people thought the American dream was dead. And even though Putnam and Murray had almost without knowing it, had almost predicted this.
Right. And, you know, and I'll say, I mean, I'm not convinced, at least in the aggregate, by either of them, because part of the theory, and this actually goes back to the Bell Curve as well as Bowling Alone, and then, you know, their more recent books, but the idea that, or rather, you know, there's a theory there that that both of them would agree with, that as a lot of bad, you know, things in society like racial or gender segregation or, you know, prejudice drop, that, you know, the paradigmatic example is that instead of a woman becoming a nurse and then marrying a doctor, you know, a woman becomes a doctor and she marries another doctor, and they kind of seal themselves away from, mm-hmm, you know, society, and mobility, inequality grows and mobility declines. And I don't think we've actually seen the decline in the mobility that is predicted, mm-hmm, by their model. And we could argue about that, but this is, you know, and there is a lively debate. There's people, you know, like Piketty and Says and Raj Chetty, who also, you know, factors into your book, versus people like Scott Winship and others who say, no, you know, mobility has basically been stable for the past 50 years or so. So, I mean, it's interesting to question that, but there's no question there is this group in America that is just doing worse and worse. And I guess,
well, and what makes Piketty not contradict Scott Winship, Piketty, mm-hmm, would say, I mean, not Piketty, Raj, right, Chetty, yes, the Stanford Harvard scholar, he says, is America a land of opportunity? It's many lands of opportunity, right, and many lands of not. In other words, we can look at the aggregate, and that's sort of what Winship is correcting the, right, people who say on the aggregate immobility is getting worse. But we don't live on the aggregate. We don't live, mm-hmm, on the spreadsheet where we get divided into our race, our age, or our education level. We live in places. And that's, mm-hmm, one of the things I really try to emphasize, right, in Alienated America, is that your place determines your outcome, mm-hmm, so much. And there are many places where immobility is on the rise. And then there are others where mobility is, right, on the rise. And they
this
might
is
even
where your birthplace, your zip code is kind of a destiny, in the same way that if you or I had been born in, Argentina rather than America, yeah, our lives would be radically different through absolutely no action on our part, good or bad, or that of our parents. So I guess one of the questions then is to say, you know, okay, so we need to kind of break down what's happening in America, you know, into smaller kind of pictures or smaller kinds of foci. How big a problem, how big is the scope of this problem in terms of, are we talking about mass numbers of people, or are we talking about people that it's a small enough number that we can be dealing with it more directly? I guess what I'm asking is, there's clearly problems. There's levels of dysfunction in certain parts of America that are bad, but is it dominant? Is it contagious? Is it taking over?
It's not a tiny problem. Mm-hmm. So if I'm talking about what portion of people I think are sort of stuck in a middle class and stuck in a working class situation and inadequately connected to other people because that's just not present in their environment, it's somewhere between 20% and 45% of the country is sort of, mm-hmm, my very rough estimate based on, mm-hmm, on what I've looked at. So that's obviously a big problem if, yeah, we have that much of a thing. So then the question is contagion. The reason to worry about contagion is that I think everybody is getting a little more alienated. It's becoming, mm-hmm, easier to not connect to other people in a meaningful way. And so more people are doing it. We just generally know our neighbors a little less than, mm-hmm, we did, and we're involved a little less than we used to be. Is that getting worse since Bowling Alone came out? I don't know, but it certainly got worse from 1960 to 2000. Everybody's, mm-hmm, a little more alienated, but either the strong religious communities or the elite communities still have kind of enough to keep improving their lives and their children's lives. And then a huge portion of the country doesn't.
So let's talk about kind of solutions or ways to address some of these problems. And I hesitate to point out, but you know, that the solutions chapter of your book is by far, you know, it's the smallest kind of chapter. And you know, many of the things that you are talking about, things you know, kind of declines in, you know, again, the economics is one thing, but then, you know, declines in church attendance, declines in marriage rates, in the denseness of family ties. These are all, you know, weakening. They have been for decades. It all predates Trump. I mean, it's kind of interesting to think about Trump both as an effect and possibly as a cause. When, you know, when you were saying we're more alienated, it's clear Americans are going to be coming out of his first term, whether it's his only term, who knows. But, you know, we're already more pissed off at each other than we were 2 years ago. So he's both an effect and a cause. But, you know, and it's not just in America. In most parts of, in most developed economies, you see declines in church attendance, declines in marriage rates, you know, kind of a splintering of family units. So what are the solutions? What are some of the policies that can help revive the dying parts of America?
You may be surprised to hear this, Nick. I do not have a federal bill that will get people to go back to church and get married.
Right.
Obviously, that would be counterproductive. And there are policy solutions. I mean, on the local level, towns and neighborhoods need to be built, I think, more about bringing people together and less around cars and more around people. Mm-hmm. There's the government should stop trying to push churches out of the public square as much as possible. The safety net should be decentralized. But I mean, so marriage, there's Republican governors have always tried to say, what can we do? What law can we pass to make people get married more? And my argument is, no, in the only incentive structure that's going to make people get married more is a stronger community that models marriage, but more importantly, sort of helps you take care of your kids and provides a safety net when things go wrong and gives you, you know, a t-ball teams to coach and all that stuff. That's the thing that's going to fix the problem. So it is hard to write the solutions chapter. I admit it in the solutions chapter.
Right.
When the solution is 20,000 smaller solutions about how to make your own neighborhood be a better place to raise kids. That
well,
said,
and
the government can stop doing things that hurt, but that's most of what the solutions are.
So well, let's talk about some of the things that the government can stop. At one point, you mentioned, you know, and this is not like you're not building an entire, you know, pyramid on this or something, a grand edifice, but stuff like tax policy that, you know, things like the mortgage interest deduction, which
that
does
push
nothing.
People to get much, it does something. It pushes people to get much bigger houses. And that, I think, can have an antisocial effect. It makes it harder just to, I mean, I just remember the Italian kids back in my neighborhood in Pelham. It was this really expensive town, but go back a generation, it wasn't. And the Italian kids, their uncles all bought houses next door to each other, which was right next door to Yaya, which is what they called their grandma. Like, how did you do that? You couldn't possibly do that where I live in the DC area. You can't just say, oh, I'm going to buy the house next door to you, because everything is just, you know, half a million, $1 million investment, and you're going to is this high stress thing. The housing market being crazy, I think, undermines community in a lot of ways.
Right. And it's also bizarre, though, because once you get outside of a few big housing markets, you know, expensive ones, houses are relatively inexpensive. So you could do that, but then people don't want to live there.
Yeah. And then, again, the
go ahead.
I was just going to say another policy that the biggest thing is the government, again, trying to push churches back into, you know, your one day a week on your Sabbath, your worship. If we can find a way to stop doing it. Now, I'm hesitant here because I don't want to say run the federal safety net through the churches, because the last thing I want as a Catholic is the federal government sticking its hands further into the way we run the church. But certainly start by letting these institutions act out in the world 7 days a week as players in the public square. That's got to be
so
one of the first steps.
Two questions, because I don't disagree with that, you know, in theory. One is, you know, talk a little bit more about how the government is not letting them do that. You brought up the Hobby Lobby decision. And, you know, it seems to me just, you know, as kind of, you know, the fact that religion is waning as a force in American life, it doesn't seem to me that, you know, Hobby Lobby, whether it was forced to or not, and, you know, it got an exception to pay for contraception, that they may or may not have been paying for before the Obamacare mandate. I mean, it gets complicated really quickly, but that isn't why people aren't going to church. How is the government putting the screws to religion? Is it more an attitude, or are there specific things?
No, there's specific policies, and a lot of it's in the name of anti-discrimination. Mm-hmm. But it's, you know, if you wanted to, there was a Christian adoption agency in South Carolina, and the Trump administration reversed an Obama administration policy to say this agency is allowed to exist. It's for if a mom is having a baby that she's not going to be able to raise, mm-hmm. and she says, but I want my child to be raised by Christians. This clashes with a lot of sort of the sentiment of a lot of America, but it also makes perfect sense to a lot of America. Yeah. But so Obama administration basically tried to drive that agency out of business by saying you're not allowed to play by those rules. And mm-hmm. so what it's doing is it's saying churches are allowed to have their own rules only in worship, but not when they step into a public square. But for Christianity, and this is also true in different ways for Judaism and Islam, for Christianity, you're not practicing your faith. You're not exercising mm-hmm. your religion if you're not out there in the public square dealing with the public, helping the needy. And so just sort of giving more leeway for institutions to have their own rules, even if you find it backwards and bigoted and discriminatory, mm-hmm. Trying to have more leeway, I think, would be benefit. But you're right. This isn't the main reason for secularization.
Oh, yeah, no. But I mean, I think what you're talking about here makes sense. And let me ask a follow-up question. You know, if big government, you know, over-centralized government at every level recedes, are you confident that civil society, like, there's enough juice, you know, or mm-hmm. you know, can the corpse be reanimated to actually pick up the space, or is all that going to do is take away a kind of, you know, federally yeah. funded safety net?
So I hit this from in both directions in the book. Mm-hmm. At one point, though, I cite a study showing that when welfare reform caused some welfare spending in places to recede, in the states that had the most aggressive curbs on the welfare, they saw the most aggressive increases in spending by churches mm-hmm. on welfare, basically. Right. So that's good. The crowding out can reverse. On the other hand, there's an old analogy a libertarian friend of mine used to say was, you don't need to teach the grass how to grow, you just need to remove the stones that are blocking mm-hmm. it. I've had enough kids leave enough crap on the grass to know that after it kills the grass and you remove them, sometimes the soil's too compacted or sometimes weeds sprout up instead.
Right.
So where the nature of alienation is not just that people aren't connected to society, it's that they don't even see the point. Mm-hmm. So in these alienated places, just getting the government out of the way isn't the same as really planting the seeds of civil society.
And to your, I think, your immense credit in the book, because I know that you're a serious Catholic. I mean, part of the problem here, too, is that, you know, and the Catholic Church is, you know, by far and away the largest, you know, worship group in America. They've not been exemplary in how they've been behaving. What are the ways that how do people in different institutions of civil society, you know, get their act together?
Yeah. No, that's exactly right. I mean, so the first sort of most pressing thought when we think about the church today is it shredding its own moral authority by covering up for sexual predators who use the fact that they have these positions of moral authority and other authority to abuse people, that not sort of going after them with sort of the fury that God would go after them was shredding authority and driving people away. And when one of the places they end up in is alienation, it makes those sins even worse. But also, I think too much on the Catholic side, there's been too much of an embrace that big government ought to be carrying out these functions, mm-hmm. and as opposed to us, the churches, and the parishes. And so going out there and sort of saying, again, if we are to be Christians, we got to do it Monday through Sunday, not just on Sunday, and
right.
we're going to do it out in the world, and to get rid of the bad teachings that sort of put the onus of social justice on the federal government instead of on the individual and on the parish. I think that also diminishes turnout at church. One reason people go to church or belong to one is that's their avenue to help other people. If you want to feed a hungry person, show up at your local church, and they're most likely to have the soup kitchen. The less that exists, the less they're bringing people through the doors.
I want to try and close on a non-super pessimistic note, because in a way, you know, I found the book really challenging, and you have, I think particularly for libertarians thinking about bigness or economic efficiency and some of the costs that don't always get tabulated into that is really important. You have a section about hyper-individualism, which I think I disagree with you on a lot of those things, but there's no question that we live in a world now where, I celebrate it that individuals are more free to live however they want. That does not come without certain costs, and a lot of people can't handle that very well. And I think you do a really good job of working through all of that. And again, it's challenging to a libertarian in particular. What is a place like Utah doing that mm-hmm. makes it a little bit different? And, you know, and part of it is that Mormonism as a kind of, you know, it's not everybody there is a Mormon or anything, but it exerts a cultural influence. But as Utah becomes a place where people want to live, you know, more different types of people are going to move there, which is good. And then it's going to change. And we're in an America where more different types of people live here now or are openly allowed to live and flourish. You know, is this just the cost of, you know, of an American dream where you can go and create your destiny? It's that you're always on a kind of knife edge of either fulfilling yourself or losing yourself.
It's right. And I'm glad you mentioned Utah and sort of the, if you go to Salt Lake City, it's pretty diverse there, actually. Mm-hmm. And it's Mormonism is the American religion. It came from the United States.
Yeah, it's like fully founded and practiced.
And one of the amazing things about America is there will be overlapping levels of civil society. So mm-hmm. you live in Salt Lake City. So there's a state government, there's a county government, there's a local government. There's also a Mormon church that plays a big role, and maybe you're part of it, and maybe it's your local ward that has an influence, or maybe you're not part of it, but they're still a neighbor, and then your neighborhood and these other organizations. So that overlappingness sort of allows mm-hmm. you to belong to some and not belong to others, be a neighbor with some and not be a neighbor with others. The church doesn't, in fact, call all the shots there, although one mm-hmm. of the criticisms is they called too many. But also in the Dutch Reformed towns, I talk mm-hmm. about this sort of victory of tolerance over some intolerance towards a Muslim center mm-hmm. that wanted to open up there. And it ended up opening up because in the end, even though one of the local pastors opposed it and some of the neighbors did, the town government that from the town next door was just like, no, we're going to allow this. So the separation of powers that is American, yeah. even if we don't necessarily realize it, that's what enables a place like Utah, I think, to get so many good outcomes, because it's not that the Mormons control everything. It's that they have the resources to provide a safety net for their own members, another safety net for sort of everybody around, a sense of duty to serve it, but still this decentralized power where you have the civil authorities, the neighborhoods, and the church all working alongside each other, sometimes against each other, mm-hmm. and overlapping. I think that's sort of a uniquely American relation between government, religion, civil society, and the individual that can provide a much better mix than I think you get in other parts of the world.
Do you think that is a model that will withstand an influx of a lot of people? And is it also someplace when you think, well, you know, actually now I'm going to withdraw that question and say, in a place like New York City or DC, and, you know, these are massive cities that have, you know, gigantic bureaucracies and all of this, they're thriving in a way that they weren't 25 years ago mm-hmm. or 30 years ago. What explains that? And is it that in spite of an overlarge government in spite of bureaucracy. You know, it's, these are actually surprisingly human scale places to live.
Well, yeah, I mean, strong little neighborhoods. I mean, you talk to a friend from New York and they'll often just keep referring to, you know, Carroll Gardens or whichever particular neighborhood they listen to, they live in. I still remember being surprised the first times I talked to people who were just really proud of being from Petworth, this neighborhood in D.C. And that just didn't really exist when I first moved here in to D.C. in 2000. So that's one thing that cities... whatever you think of the city as a whole, they're so thickly planted with people and then with institutions and with people who will start and become institutions, whether it's a bookstore or that sort of thing, that a place that has a ton of that, that, you know, a corporation will look at and say, oh, well, there's a lot of good human capital there. The inside of that is there's a lot of people who are going to create institutions that, that bring people together. So the cities that are doing well, that's the way to look at it, is if you zoom out too far, you're missing the point. If you zoom in, you see, okay, this isn't that New York City is doing well. It's that New York City has dozens of neighborhoods that are doing really well.
To talk about a different type of institution, you're part of the Washington Examiner, which has recently launched a magazine and has absorbed, I guess, some of the circulation of the Weekly Standard, which was shuttered. What's going on with the Examiner, and why should people be particularly excited about this?
Well, so the magazine is the cover story is going to be an excerpt from Alienated America this week.
Okay.
But it's an effort to look at America more broadly. Most of the web stuff we do on a day-to-day basis is drilling down into, you know, Pat Toomey and Rob Portman's trade bill, and this is an effort to zoom out and look at the broader culture. One of the sections we have is called Your Land, like this land is your land, because culture is
So you're going full communist.
Politics.
Yeah, this is like Woody Guthrie is...
Yeah, no, we stop after the first couple lines of the song.
Yeah.
But that what we're doing and bringing in writers from all parts, and then sort of continuing also our effort to be a conservative publication in the Trump era that doesn't let Donald Trump tell us what to think one way or another.
Right.
A lot of people either oppose or support him one way or another, and we will acknowledge him. But from the magazine perspective, it's more of a sort of a refreshing thing. There are things going on in this country, and we don't just have to be talking about what he just tweeted and what he wants us to talk about.
What, you know, in terms of kind of conservative politics and Republican politics, the 2018 midterms were kind of a godsend, because now there's a whole bunch of kind of, you know, extreme progressive leftists, you know, that everybody can get behind if you're right of center. Right. But what is your sense of, like, Donald Trump, among other things, he has, you know, he made immigration, you know, the hallmark issue of the Republican Party, or not even immigration, but building a wall. He's anti-free trade. He's reversed so many aspects of the Republican identity. Do you think, is this a good thing or a bad thing? Does the Republican Party and the conservative movement and they've split, you know, as you were saying, I mean, some people, and it, amazingly, you know, when evangelical Christians are like more fully behind, you know, the president than, you know, say somebody like Bill Kristol or, you know, a neoconservative globalist. You know, what is your sense of where the Republican Party ends up, you know, even going into the 2020 nomination? Is it a coherent coalition, or is it something that's going to need to be really completely rethought and a lot of purges and a lot of new blood brought in?
I think it's been totally, the sort of old bonds that tied it together have been totally fractured. There's this one guy, Trump, and that when he's gone one way or another, it's going to be interesting. And I mean, because I don't particularly have an attachment to any party, the idea of a sorting and a debate, that's the sort of thing I love, right?
Right.
Is these talks and these ideas. And so, you know, I've been talking about populism for over a decade.
Yep.
I was gearing it at battling corporate welfare. Trump has a different approach to his populism, but to let populism be part of the conversation will be interesting. The conversation's not going to happen until Trump's gone one way or another. And anybody who tells you how it's going to shake out, they're making it up. But I think as somebody who loves idea debates and has no particular attachment to the GOP, I look forward to the shaking out.
Well, and, you know, I was going to say there's clearly something going on in in Democratic politics, as well as to a broader sense, liberal or progressive, that, you know, like who's going to run the left, you know, side of the political spectrum, because, you know, when you have Nancy Pelosi telling you know, protesters that, look, we're capitalists in the Democratic Party, so take the Green New Deal or whatever. She made some disparaging remark and, you know, basically shove it up your ass. You know, there's, I mean, something's going on there. Can you define quickly, because you talked at various points in your career about things like a libertarian populism. There's clearly a conservative populism and a progressive populism. What is it that knits this populism together? What need is being served by a resurgence in populism? And what links it across kind of ideological affiliations?
A lot of it is an expression of anger at being stripped of the ability to exercise your political muscle. If you look at when you had the congresswoman, was it Ilhan Omar, who was tearing into Elliot Abrams, there were people saying, so this guy has been, who is involved in these wars and caught up in all the debates about war crimes, he's finally getting scolded. So the people who care about these issues say, yeah, these elites were protected and we didn't have anybody speaking for us. And so when I would write about libertarian populism, I would point out that both parties want big business and big government to work together. And there's just the way Washington is set up. There's no channel for people to have any power to take on the corporate welfare, because sort of the bipartisanship made it happen. So it's that sense that you don't have access to power that's behind all of the populisms. Of course, my answer is, if we strip the power away from the federal government, then you'll have access to other power. But on the left, there is a belief that, you know, with the right campaign finance reform and enough Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is in the House, well, then, you know, we the people will finally have power.
Do you worry that what, you know, when you, if you take a kind of left-wing populism, right-wing populism, libertarian populism, and you sit them on top of each other, the stuff that sifts out, you know, the things that are in common are going to be really bad, because it's, you know, it could be that we, you know, the federal government stays gigantically large, but there are more consumer advocates or something. I don't know. I mean, is
And so I, by the time Trump won the nomination, I said, look, I thought that 2012 was a chance to sort of, for the Republican Party to embrace a free market libertarian populism. And instead, they tried to push it underwater and it came back up as this orange haired monster. And that that the left populism is, has sort of more specific promises to offer, gets to be Santa Claus. Both the Trumpian and the left populism get to be Santa Claus, while my populism was, we're going to stop them from screwing you over, but I kind of have to stop there, because anything more would be counterproductive. So it's hard for me to win in an intra-populist fight. I'm agreeing with your premise there.
No, well, hopefully something, you know, maybe, I don't know, the alien invasion that Krugman is always talking about will happen, but it won't be that bad, but it'll unite us and liberate us all. We have been talking with Tim Carney. He is the author, most recently, of Alienated America, Why Some Places Thrive While Others Collapse. This has been the Reason Podcast. I've been your host, Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening.